Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Hormones are the potent chemicals that control so much. Our immune system, sleep, metabolism, mood swings. But how much do we really know about hormones? As Dr. Randi Hutter-Epstein writes in her new book, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything, hormones aim to get us back to normal when things are out of whack, but they can also be the cause of major commotion. In her book, Dr. Epstein reveals the fascinating and shocking history of hormones through the back rooms, basements, and labs where endocrinology began. Dr. Epstein is an adjunct professor at Columbia University and a lecturer at Yale University, and she joins us from New York. Hi, Dr. Epstein. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and what an interesting, fascinating, and somewhat shocking book. Before we dive in and talk about all of the history that you reveal, let's just talk about hormones more generally, because we hear a lot about hormones, and people tend to associate hormones with puberty and sex, but as you write, they control so many things about our overall lives.
Yes, I mean, we think of hormones as boobs and sex and puberty. We also think of hormones as hormonal, as if women going off the rails are hormonal, but yet our husbands, our partners, boys, our dogs, our tortoises, everyone has them. But yeah, and we don't appreciate that there's all sorts of hormones that control our metabolism, that do control our moods, that do work with the immune system in ways we're just beginning to understand, that work with our brain signaling in ways we're just beginning to understand. So I think that's what drew me into the book and to this topic, is that it's so much more complicated than we tend to think.
Is this something that Western doctors spend much time talking about? Because last year, after the election, you know, so many people went to their doctors saying they were stressed out, and I'll include myself in that group. And after I started doing a lot of research about sleep and stress, I started reading more about cortisol. And I just wasn't getting many answers from my regular doctor, so I went to a naturopathic doctor. And I went down this entire journey of taking all of these blood tests and really found out that my hormones were totally out of whack.
Well, here's one thing we have to be careful with, that when you go for blood tests, it's very important that you have them measured by an accredited lab. There's so many places that might tell you you're low on this and high on that when it might not be the best testing. There's actually something out now, an organization called PATH, P-A-T-H. You can Google them. They're very adamant about making sure that people can Google the lab or look at the lab that they're at or where your doctor is testing the blood to make sure when they say you're low, you really are low. When you're high, you really are high before you go down some path that you may not want to go down. Cortisol is interesting because it's a stress hormone, but it's also the hormone when we think of the body as being stressed. Yes, there's some mental stress, but it's also the stress hormone in the sense of if you have surgery, that's stress on the body, and we need cortisol to kick in to get the immune system going, to get over the surgery. It's not always easy to figure out in terms of emotional stress the sharp tie to what that's doing chronically to our cortisol levels.
You write that, I mean, this is fascinating when you think about just how the body works. If you consider your body a vast information highway, your nervous system works like an old-fashioned operator switchboard. It contains wires that need to be plugged into the source and the target in order to transmit signals. And you can follow the path of a nerve from one end to the other, but hormones are a different story altogether. The remarkable thing about them, as opposed to all the other substances in your body, is the seemingly magical way they work. Hormones are pinballed from one cell in one part of the body and reach faraway targets. No connection is needed. So it's almost like a wireless network. So can you explain how this works exactly? I thought that was a really good visual.
Sure. I love that visual because I say your hormones are like your internal Wi-Fi. And to be honest, I don't really understand Wi-Fi. I can't even turn my television on in my house, and that's not a joke. I actually cannot turn the television on in my house. And when things are wrong with my Wi-Fi, I just text my husband and say, the damn Wi-Fi is down again. But I know that I can use my computer, and there's routers, and I know that my messages go, hopefully, to a specific target. And that's what hormones do. And you have to realize that it was a shocking concept when doctors in the early 1900s were talking about this new way. So basically what they were saying, and they were right, is your pituitary, which is a tiny little gland that dangles off the back of your brain, it will release hormones. Those hormones will know specifically whether they need to get to the testes or the adrenal gland, just the way that your wireless internet, as far as I know, knows where it's supposed to reach at the end. So originally, when these doctors came out and said, wow, we have this new way the body works, like these chemicals, they didn't use that Wi-Fi metaphor in the early 1900s, but they said they know how to get to their target. You can imagine that most doctors at the time said, that can't be. There must be nerves. That's how messages travel. So obviously you're not looking hard enough. There must be even tinier nerves that you don't see. So it doesn't seem like a controversial thing now, but it was really controversial. And I scoured the newspapers and scientific journals. There was heated debate of people trying to trash this new concept.
What do you hope to accomplish with your book? Because you have so many interesting stories about the history of hormones. I mean, is this something that you talk about or learn about in medical school?
We do. And I think what I'm hoping that readers and listeners get from the book is that, and what drew me in, is that the past century has just been this amazing time of discovery, yet also audacious claims. And I'm just hoping that after you read the book, you'll be able to sort of say, ah, oh, that's real, and that's a huge advance. And I do get into sort of what we're aiming for in the future. And then you can say, oh, but that's hype. That's silly. I don't need to buy into that. So I'm really hoping that people can separate the hype from the hoax. And it's been something that people have had to grapple with since the field started.
And before we get into the history, just one more basic question. What else do you think listeners need to know about the importance of hormones? Why should they learn more about hormones?
Hormones are us. They explain our behavior. They explain our hunger drive. They explain our libido. They explain our lack of libido. But I also want people to understand that we tend to visualize maybe that hormones each has its own pipeline, like a bunch of garden hoses next to each other. But really, think more like cobweb. They're all connected. So if you're thinking, oh, maybe I need a little more of this hormone, maybe that'll make me happier, well, it might also affect your sugar metabolism. It might also affect other things that we know and things we might not know.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you uncovered. One of the earliest experiments that revealed something about the chemicals we now know as hormones was done by a German doctor, Dr. Arnold Berthold, in his backyard in 1848. He castrated roosters and then implanted a rooster with a testicle and watched as the rooster went from fat, sluggish, and disinterested in sex back into a vigorous hen chaser. Talk a little bit about this rooster experiment, and why did you decide to include this in your book?
I included it for two reasons. One is, I mean, come on, it's a testicle castrating rooster experiment, so you just can't leave that out. But it has two key things in it, two key messages. One is, this doctor in 1848 did the very first hormone experiment that really explains how hormones work, released in one part of the body, targets something far away. He wrote it up in a medical journal, and then he kind of went on his way and just did other things. So it shows that if you're going to do science and you want to make a difference, one, you have to do a good experiment. Check. He did that. Two, you should write it up in a medical journal so people can see how you did it and then write about it and discuss it. He did that. But you also need to understand the significance of what you've done and really try to make a difference. He didn't do that. So basically, this landmark study got lost on a shelf somewhere in a German library, and it wasn't uncovered until 50 years later. So there was this huge gap of the first hormone study, and then 50 years later, that's when the field got started. The other thing, in terms of just the study itself, that's hugely significant is that I don't know what drove this doctor to think about doing this. He didn't just castrate testicles and sew them back on in between those little drumsticks. They didn't sew them back on, but other farmers had castrated their poultry before. He took off the testicles, and then he implanted the testicle in the intestines of a castrated rooster. So he wanted to know, hey, could whatever magical thing is inside a testicle work no matter where I put it in the body? And it did. And it was really shocking because people thought, no, it has to be in the right place. But it doesn't. That's why we can give people hormone injections if they need them, because they'll know where to go. They'll know the targeted cells to go to.
And as a doctor, when you first read about that, what was your reaction?
Maybe you shouldn't do experiments in your backyard. But I think what I thought of were the two things. Like, how do people think about these things? You know, we take certain things for granted, and I think it takes the real pioneers to break out of taking things for granted and say, well, could this work this way or why? I mean, the real scientists, and he was a real scientist, even if he didn't promote what he did, are those people that say why. And I think I don't have the patience to be a scientist, and maybe I don't have I just don't have what they have that makes them ask those wonderful questions, but I'm enamored by the scientists who do. And I'm excited when I read about these really wonderful scientists who come up with questions, because that's the best scientists. They're not the ones that find the answers. The answer, once you get the study, is, I wouldn't say easy, but it's there. You follow the path. The greatest scientists have posed the best questions.
You write that this doctor, scientist Berthold, had assumed that when he carved his poultry, he would find a network of nerves connecting the displaced testicles to the body. Instead, he found the testicles were surrounded by blood vessels. And in his 4-page scientific report, he explained for the very first time how hormones work, writing that his experiment showed that the testes released a substance into the blood that was carried off to the rest of the body and reached a specific destination, which is incredible. And he was right. Hormones are released in one part of the body and reach a specific target like a well-aimed arrow from a bow. But as you write, he didn't use the word hormone because it wasn't coined for another half century.
That's correct. And actually, a half century later, when British researchers did a similar sort of experiment with a dog, and again, people were like, well, there must have been nerves. There must have been nerves there. But they were the ones in 1905, these British researchers, that said, okay, we need a name for this now. Here's a concept. We need a name for all these chemicals. Because at one point when we started studying glands, you had in the late 1800s, there were adrenal gland researchers and pituitary researchers and ovary researchers, but they didn't talk to each other. They didn't see any reason to. It would be like telling neurosurgeons and dentists they should be in the same organization. And it wasn't until 1905 where these two British researchers rediscovered this German experiment, redid it, agreed, and then said, now we need a name for these chemicals. So they did what doctors do. They wanted sort of an enlightened name that came from the Greek. We love to look to the Greek for names. And he said to his University of Cambridge friend who was a classics professor, give me a Greek word that means to arouse. Now, he was thinking, which maybe many of the people that see the cover of my book are thinking, oh, arouse as in arousing cells, arouse as in chemicals in the body, arouse. And the Cambridge University professor said, how about something along the lines of hormoa? And that's where he came to the word hormone. Interestingly, again, because doctors love to fight and grapple, there were people that said, oh, hormone's not a good name. How about this one? Another doctor suggested autocoid. And now that sounds kind of weird. Like, we don't go around saying, I feel so autocoital today. But it was kind of a good word, autocoid, because that came from inner drug, which also sort of makes sense. But anyhow, hormones stuck. So that's what we call them, hormones.
And this particular experiment was these two men, William Bayliss and Erlis Sterling, removed the nerves near a dog's gut. And when the dog was fed, the pancreas produced digestive secretions despite the absence of those nerves. And this proved that the nerves had nothing to do with internal secretions. They proposed that the glands that created secretions in the body were part of a larger interconnected system. Again, why is this one so important? And what was your reaction when you read about this study?
Oh, this study's fun again in two ways that seem sort of disconnected. One that's an interesting fun fact is these British doctors were friends and colleagues of Pavlov. You know, he's the Russian scientist that when you ring a bell, dogs salivate. And he was very prominent in those days. And Pavlov said, you're absolutely wrong. There are nerves there. They're so tiny. Maybe they're invisible nerves. But again, Pavlov was wrong. They were right. The other crazy thing about this experiment is this experiment, unlike that bird one done in 1848, these doctors did this experiment right around the time there was a huge increase of animal activists protecting animals in England. So unbeknownst to them at the time, when they were demonstrating their hormone experiment and doing what they did to the dog to teach people about their new theory, these two women were in their class. These two women were medical students at the all-women's medical school. They got special permission to sit in on the lecture because there were no laboratories in the women's school. It wasn't thought appropriate for the women. It also wasn't appropriate in 1905 to have men and women in medical school together there. They thought it would just be too many intimate topics shouldn't be discussed in a co-ed class. What these women were doing, they weren't there to learn. They were there to accuse the doctor of abusing an animal. So while this hormone landmark experiment was done, what happened in London were huge riots that night. Hmm. These women walked out. They got all their activist friends to march in Trafalgar Square. They went to Battersea. I won't go through the whole story, which I detail in my book, but I can tell you they had a big statue built to memorialize that poor dog that was killed in the lab. It eventually got taken down. And if you go to Battersea Park in London today, you can find a smaller version of they call it the brown dog statue. And it says that it's a memorial of the tortures that was done to animals. It doesn't say anything that it was a landmark experiment.
Hmm. And then these two women also wrote an anti-vivisection book describing what they saw called Shambles of Science, extracts from the diary of two students of physiology.
Yes, they did, and it ended up going to court. Now, it didn't go to court because the women sued the doctors for breaking any animal safety rules. There were rules then in England that they were in 1876. The British did have rules against the mistreatment of animals for experimentation. Mm-hmm. The women didn't take the doctors to court. One of the doctors actually took the women to court for libel, for basically giving them a bad name. And the way things were then in society, the court sided with the doctors and they actually got off the hook. And it turned out that that actually the doctors got some money for this. So they won in the long run. It got people more annoyed than after that. You can imagine there were a lot of then fights after the court case too.
Today, we are speaking with Dr. Randi Hutter Epstein about her new book, Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control just about everything. We're talking about metabolism, behavior, sleep, stress, mood swings, the immune system, fighting, fleeing, parenting, and then puberty and sex. Those two tend to get the most attention when we talk about hormones, but they affect so much of our lives. And if you have any questions for Dr. Epstein about hormones, is this something that you've talked to your doctor about? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. What sort of research would you like to see about hormones? Dr. Epstein writes about the history of hormones and then what we know today and what we still need to know. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And coming up in about 20 minutes, we will get an update on the crisis of children being separated from their families. We have an email from Leslie who says, women seem to have different responses to their hormonal system changes after menopause. Many say there's still some hormonal function of the ovaries. What additional effects might a post-menopause woman expect after a total hysterectomy with the removal of the ovaries?
Well, when women have a total hysterectomy, that puts them in menopause because it, especially with the removal of the ovaries. And now, because of women talking more about it, and now because of more research, we're starting to understand more about what goes on. It can affect your sex life. It can affect your mood swings. It can cause hair dryness and changes in skin. Fortunately for a lot of women, and it really varies depending on why you had the hysterectomy, depending on your family history, but there are a lot of both hormonal and non-hormonal treatments that can be done to deal with these issues. What I've found, though, is when I talk to doctors and I read the scientific journals, you get, you know, here's the choices. You could be on an estrogen patch, or you could be pills, and it all seems not easy, but there are a lot of choices out there. What I found talking to women, and I spoke to a lot of women, and I'm 55, I have a lot of menopausal female friend women. A lot of it is so insidious that there are things that are hormonal that you just might say, oh, I'm just getting old, or, oh, I'm bored with my partner. My sex drive is going down because, well, I'm 55, or I'm just stressed at work, so that's why I feel more jittery. One of the things that can happen at menopause that people don't talk about that much, we talk about the hot flashes, and that's because our thermostat is totally mucked up, and we're really learning more about that. But the other thing that can happen is when you have these hot flashes, which if you ask any menopausal woman, it's not just like, oh, I'm hot. It's, oh my God, this inner thermos inside me is just boiling up. And you feel not just hot and sweaty, but you feel almost panicky. It's like this claustrophobic feeling. You can ask women that have, you know, that have gone through menopause or going through this perimenopausal phase, and for the first time, they'll be in a small, crowded room or an elevator or a subway and feel like, I got to get out now. I got to get out. So it's not just like, oh, it's a hot day. It's like, I need air. I need space. There are treatments. There are hormonal and non-hormonal ways. There's new things in the pipeline. But I think for many women, what I've found, it also helped for them to realize, oh, I'm not getting a panic attack for the first time in my life out of nowhere. This is hormonal related. This is menopausal related. And this shakiness or lack of air that I'm feeling in the subway or the small plane is just menopausal related, and it'll pass in a few minutes. Sometimes that's all women need to hear, or at least to complain to each other about.
Thank you for the email, Leslie. Today we're joined by Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, author of Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with historian and activist Martin Duberman about his new book, Has the Gay Movement Failed? He argues that the left has sidelined radical goals to achieve more normative inclusion. That is tomorrow. And all week, we will be bringing you the latest on children who have been separated from their parents will go to Texas to get an update in about 15 minutes. Today, we are joined by Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, adjunct professor at Columbia University and a lecturer at Yale University. Dr. Epstein is out with a new book called Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. And if you have any questions or comments about hormones, we'd love to hear from you. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. We have an email from Heather who says, I just wanted to share with you and listeners the current Radiolab podcast series. A woman from California had her ovary removed and frozen, and then her ovary was transplanted under her belly button. She had the first baby born from this new fertility surgery. Dr. Epstein, do you know about this?
I actually don't know about that specific woman that you're speaking of, but I do know about this research. And again, I mean, that goes back to, we know that hormones can work wherever you put them in the body. One of the things that's been really tricky for women that have had to have their ovaries removed or that are worried about their fertility, because sometimes women have to undergo chemotherapy for a cancer that has nothing to do with their ovaries, but the chemotherapy itself can damage the ovaries. And so women can have a cancer that they know they're going to survive and then feel like, but I don't want to lose my fertility. So we've been trying to figure out what we can do to preserve their fertility. Eggs are really fragile. It's really hard to freeze an egg. We are doing it. We're freezing women's eggs, but they're very, very fragile. They're not as easy to freeze as sperm, which are really easy to freeze. I'm not sure how many of your listeners have tried that. But ovaries are easier to freeze. And so there has been research going on in terms of preserving an ovary. And as what was obviously said on Radiolab, you can put them back in a different location, and it will, and hope, and it worked with this woman, start churning out the hormones that you need. Yeah. The key thing also is freezing and making sure that the ovary stays healthy as it's being frozen and then gets back into the right environment, back into the body.
Well, thank you for that email, Heather. We'll find that Radiolab series and we'll put it up at our website right after the show. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Amanda in San Francisco. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi, Rose. Thank you for taking my call. The reason that I'm calling, and I'm sure your expert today will know about this, is I am the product of a hormonal experiment. I am what is known as a DES daughter. That stands for diethylstilbestrol. I won't go into the backstory on it. But essentially, when my mother was pregnant with me, this was in the 1950s, it was very common that they were given this drug, DES. And what it did is it bathed their baby in very, very, very high doses of estrogen. And consequently, they discovered as these daughters grew up, hit puberty or beyond, that it's considered a hormonal disruptor. It's a synthetic hormonal disruptor. And I had my reproductive tract. It's a malformed uterus. I was never able to have children. Mm-hmm. And DES is now also known to cause higher incidence of breast cancer in these children that were exposed in utero to DES. And I just wonder if your expert could address that issue.
And just quickly, Amanda, when did you learn about all of this?
Well, I learned about it when I started to try to have children, and I couldn't. So I had an exam, and it was discovered that I have what's called a T-shaped uterus. It's not the shape of a normal uterus, and it will not hold a child. And then I became very active in this, and I realized that there were people all over our country, I think there were like 5 million women who were exposed to this drug, various forms of problems, some of whom were developing very early cancers and would have to have a horrible operation called a vaginectomy, removing every single organ in their body. I don't know if they'd still do that. But I went to Congress and lobbied to Congress, and I said, we are canaries of the coal mine. Please look at hormones. Please look at, you know, hormone therapy, what you are giving to people. And I was able to sit on a, sorry, it makes me nervous to talk about this. I was able to sit on a panel in Washington, D.C., through the Office of Women's Health, where we established protocols for training doctors to identify this and also the proper treatment these women, including myself, should have.
Wow. Amanda, thank you for sharing your story. Dr. Epstein?
Amanda's 100% right. It was a huge tragedy. She is not exaggerating any of this. Thanks so much for Amanda for bringing this up. In the 1950s, when this drug was given out, in the 1950s and 60s, there was this thought that we now know is not right, that the placenta, that the baby in the womb is protected from anything dangerous so that nothing toxic could happen. And DES, which is a synthetic estrogen, was really the first drug that made us realize that you could give, that there could be these long-lasting or latent effects. So when Amanda was born, she probably looked 100% healthy. There was no reason for anyone during her childhood to start x-raying her uterus and see what shape it was. She looked like a healthy baby. And it wasn't until 20 years after the fact that a very wise doctor listened to one of his patients whose daughter in her 20s got vaginal cancer. That's a really rare cancer. It's really rare to get in your 20s. And this mom said to this doctor, you know, I was on DES. Could that have anything to do with it? Rather than ignoring this patient and thinking, how could DES have anything to do with it? Because we really didn't think that way those days, that there could be these latent the latent impacts of the hormones. He really dug into it, and other doctors did, and they brought it to Congress, and then DES was banned for the use of in pregnancy. Not only, it was sad for, tragic for so many reasons. One is, for some women, it was given out almost like a vitamin. So there are women today that are infertile, and they may not know if their mom had DES because it was just given out the way you were given prenatal vitamins, and it might not, and their charts might not be there. And secondly, it also, at the time that DES was given out, it really shows sometimes how medicine works. The doctors that promoted it were Harvard doctors, and they were adamant that DES was safe and that it prevented miscarriages. A few other doctors repeated the study. They didn't at first see the dangers, but they said, wait, it doesn't look like the miscarriage rate is any different. But the doctors at Harvard had a lot of clout, and they said, well, your study's probably wrong, and yes, we should continue to use DES. There's a doctor I write about in Aroused who was one of the first female reproductive endocrinologists. And among the wonderful things that she did, Georgiana Jones was a really data-focused, serious scientist and a compassionate doctor. Before we knew any of the dangers about DES in the 1960s, she looked at the data and said, I don't see proof that this reduces miscarriage, and I'm also not sure that it's such a great idea to give high doses of estrogen to pregnant women, so this drug is not going to be allowed to be used at Johns Hopkins Hospital. So those women were, there are women that didn't get the drug who wanted it because some doctors saw and just said the data's not there. But Amanda's right. Millions of women were given DES, and women were begging their doctors for it because the thinking was, and the newspapers and magazines presented it as if, like, even if you never had a miscarriage, why not take this and prevent a potential miscarriage? And yes, they're still suffering the side effects. There's women with what they do call, she said, T-shaped uterus. Your uterus should be more shaped like a vase, not a T. Babies can't grow in a T. It increases the risk of vaginal cancer. There's been studies to look at baby boys that have been exposed, and they might have fertility issues as well because of the DES. There's also research going into whether it's really change the DNA that grandchildren of DES babies. So it's a huge tragedy. And when people wonder why are some women afraid of hormones or why do we fear, it's because when you look back in history, there has been issues like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again, Amanda, for calling in and sharing your story. Today, we are joined by Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein, author of Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Heather writes in, it's been studied that by reducing animal foods that produce more estrogen in the body, women can reduce the dramatic change in estrogen and symptoms are less severe or avoided altogether. More reason to eat plant-based and consume less, especially dairy, eggs, and poultry. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we really don't know. Those studies, you know, there's a lot of things that make sense, but we've gone off the wrong path if things make sense, and then we follow it, but we don't have the data. It's really hard to do the studies, and we are trying. It's very hard to do the studies to track someone's exact diet and where their water was, what exposures from their water, from chemicals. So there's hints, but I'm not sure that there's really conclusive evidence to say that if you have less dairy or less meat, it's going to have that much of an impact on your estrogen. But we are on the verge of doing studies to try to work through issues of hormones in meats from giving animals too many hormones to plump them up, which probably isn't necessary, and our exposure and what happens to that. There are studies going on looking at chemicals that are dumped in the water that gets into our system. So we're starting to untangle that now. So I think we're at a very exciting time in research, and hopefully we can reduce the amount of extra hormones in the animals and in the water supply, because we don't need to be mucking about with our hormone system. But we're not quite there yet in terms of conclusively saying that definitely you need to have the vegetarian diet's going to be the one for you.
We have time for one more call. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm the fourth pregnancy, third child of my mother, who took DES for my two older sisters. But all the chemicals, all the man-made chemicals that we've had almost no tests on, also affect hormones. They either mimic or they disrupt body functions. I have multiple chemical sensitivity, and I developed diabetes too. Has doctor mentioned anything about that?
Oh, thanks for asking. And I think this also plays, I mean, to me, this is very similar to the last question about hormones in beef. And we're really trying to uncover this now. The problem is doing the really detailed studies that we need to do, and some doctors are doing. What I can say, it's very hard to track whether the water you've drank for your life and we've moved around, if that's the cause of the hormone issues. What I think, what's going on now and I think will reveal is some animal studies and rodent studies where we intentionally put extra estrogens and hormones in their water and then see what happens. And we are seeing, yes, it does impact babies. It does impact brain development. I think we need to push to have more research, and we have to then think about what steps can we do to reduce potential risks. So we may not know for sure what all these extra hormones are doing, but maybe before we know for sure, it might be time to take some precautions, to take some prevention, and try to make sure that we're not mucking up our bodies and our systems and our environment in ways that we don't even know. So I'm not saying we don't know we shouldn't do anything. I'm sort of saying the opposite. We don't know, but it's time to take some precautions rather than wait to find out.
Yes. In fact, we're planning to do a whole show on chemicals and environmental toxicity. That'll be coming up in the next couple of weeks. Final question. On Facebook, Haymeen writes about DES and says that, you know, the fact is Harvard doctors promoted this. And she has an interesting, very important question. If this is the effect of allowing pharmaceuticals to advertise directly to the public, so how can people adequately know when, in this case, Harvard researchers were wrong? I mean, we're bombarded. One of two countries, I believe, New Zealand and the United States, only countries in the world where people are bombarded with pharmaceutical ads on television.
It drives me crazy. I have to say, this is what you can do. You can't go out and get a scientific degree, but I would say, don't get your scientific information from testimonials. I've had doctors hand to me, oh, take this, it's really good, and they're handing me the insert, the advertisement, and I'll say, no, 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 give me the scientific paper. Ask for the scientific paper. It doesn't mean that you have to understand it, but usually you can understand the conclusion or the abstract. Ask for the science. Ask your doctor. And this might sound a little crazy, but I think we have to do this in this day and age. If your doctor is promoting something that you think, well, how accurate is this? Ask your doctor. Do you have financial ties to this company? I did that. I love my doctor. And at one point when she was talking about hormone replacement, and I'm on hormone replacement therapy, so I'm not against it, but I did say to her, do you have any financial ties to the estrogen companies? I think you want to know. I think, you know, it's sad that we have to do that, but I think we have to think about, yeah, get your information from articles and scientific papers rather than advertisements, and speak to your doctor, and make sure that you're speaking to a doctor that you really feel that you can trust.
Dr. Randy Hutter Epstein is adjunct professor at Columbia University and a lecturer at Yale University, and her new book is Aroused, The History of Hormones and How They Control Just About Everything. Dr. Epstein, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you. And coming up after a very short break, we will get an update on children who have been separated from their families. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.